Larry, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, many thanks for that much too generous introduction. Actually, my notes say check before delivery, but that actually was much too generous. So I'll proceed. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be here. I mean, first of all, I have a lot of old friends in the audience from my days working in America, first for Heritage, Ed Fulner, Barbara Smith, as was. I've forgotten your married name, Barbara. Bob Schudinger, who founded Policy Review, the first magazine I edited, and Bridget, of course, who, as you said, now runs Heritage, just as before her, Kathy Rowan and Missy Stevens did. So it's a very great pleasure to be here. It's a particular privilege, of course, to be invited to give the opening address at the conference. When I got the invitation, I immediately thought, aha, I must be late with my membership dues. And nothing like an invitation to give a public speech to get a fellow out on a Friday night. Last time, by the way, the invitation cost me the membership dues plus the cost of coming from Washington. That was the most I'd ever paid for giving a public speech. This time I came here from Australia, the long way round via Budapest. In your list of things, you didn't mention I'm now commuting between Sydney and Budapest as editor of Quadrant, Larry, but not for too long. Now, the title of my talk, I had down somewhere as How People Around the World See the November Election, or something like that. I didn't choose the title. I always call my talks Rendezvous with Destiny. it doesn't really mean anything. It's sort of grand, and it gets less plausible with every passing year that Destiny has arranged an interview with me. Unless, of course, Destiny is one of those ladies with exotic names who write to me occasionally from erotically themed websites. And on this occasion, the title might, given where we are in the elections, it might even be apposite. Because, Larry, looking at the November election and at the turmoil that it has produced within the conservative movement, I think this may be the very first talk on conservatism that leads to a barroom brawl in the audience. Until very recently, the idea of a fist fight between the editors of National Review and the Claremont Journal would have been inconceivable. A fistfight between the editors of Chronicles and Commentary, less so. We can all imagine that. But things have come to a pretty pass when half of the conservative movement is not on speaking terms with the other half because one of them might vote Republican. Or might not vote Republican without the excuse of being a libertarian. This spoiling for a fight reminds me of an occasion in the Kildare Street Club in Dublin, where a friend of Larry's, Peter Utley, a blind Tory journalist of great distinction, was drinking there. His wife, Bridget, who acted as his eyes, said to him, "Look, there's that Irish nationalist journalist we met the other night, very cordial fellow, but he's striding up and down, pacing back and forth, stopping every now and then to glare at us." Eventually, the journalist, the writer, the Irish nationalist, stopped pacing, came over, and said, "Utley, I read your article today in the Daily Telegraph. It was an absolute disgrace, and I want you to know that I'm cutting you." In other words, it was the only way he could tell him. He had to announce that he wouldn't ever talk to him or see him again. Today, senior conservatives are cutting themselves, or each other rather, in battalions in the public square, while beyond the city walls, the drummings and ululations of the alt-right fall ominously on the night air. Reagan's 11th commandment, "Thou shalt speak ill of no other Republican," has been thrown overboard. It should all make, Larry, it should all make for an absolutely terrific conference this weekend. Now, the election is a different matter. Consider first not the significant political issues involved in the primaries. in the Trump and Sanders campaigns particularly, but the overall feel of the race. The serious issues that emerged in the first half of the election campaign, nationalism, economic protectionism, political correctness, a less interventionist foreign policy, they have all been overshadowed, if not obliterated, by the antics, the gaffes, and the plausibly alleged crimes of Clinton and Trump. Maybe the best metaphor for the current state of the race is one Donald Trump himself has used, the fixed fight. On this occasion, however, it looks as if the mob has blundered and bribed both candidates to take a fall. So they stagger around the ring, hurling loud blows at each other, but also leaving their defenses wide open, suffering, therefore, blows of equal noise until the bell rings and they fall back exhausted into the arms of their staff trainers. Each seems to be fighting to lose in his or her distinctive way. Clinton is being undermined by the continuing drip, drip, drip of her own emails that show her to have lied and broken federal laws during and since her time as Secretary of State. Trump is being derailed at intervals by his own gaffes and insults, such as, most recently, his alleged fat-shaming of a homicidal gangster's moll, whom he once employed comparatively respectably as a beauty queen. Fat-shaming being a worse crime than gangsterism and attempted murder in the eyes of feminism and the media. The Clinton campaign is taking advantage of this episode and promoting the beauty queen. And to be fair, one can see why her excusatory motto, "We all have a past," might appeal to the Clinton campaign. But both presidential candidates, as a result, are two of the most distrusted people in America. Each overtakes the other at intervals, depending on whether her lies or his gaffes dominate the headlines. Clinton has the current advantage because there's been a lull in the release of her emails, and Trump floundered somewhat in the first debate. But that may well change in the light of later events. There are a full 6 weeks of hyperactive campaigning and two presidential debates to go between now and Election Day. So, as my title asks, how does all this strike the rest of the world? The short answer is it strikes the rest of the world as exciting and entertaining, but as neither serious nor hopeful. American elections are always good box office, because, unlike other elections, people don't know how they're going to turn out. But they often, as now, strike the intelligent foreign observer as a kind of tabloid nonsense that makes people say, "Hey, that's America. Anything can happen there." Much more troublingly, though, when the foreign media tries to go beneath the surface and convey the serious matters at stake, they tend to repeat the liberal interpretations of the Washington press corps, what Paul Johnson calls the seven deadly sinners. The Times, the Post, Time, Newsweek, the ABC, NBC, and CBS. In America, their monopoly of interpretation has been undermined by talk radio, the social media, Fox News, and other insurgent media. But the Washington press corps is still unduly influenced by the foreign press corps, by the legacy media. And Peter Bauer's old maxim applies particularly strongly to transatlantic communications. What matters in today's world is not the sound, but the echo. So when Sir Max Hastings was asked by The Spectator what he made of the election campaign, he replied simply, "If Trump wins, it will be a mass retreat from reason." So Max himself is a moderate conservative, and he quoted other moderate and intelligent people, like the historian Michael Howard, another sir, as expressing the same or similar views. A Google search would find many more such views right across the political spectrum. I will sum up the collective wisdom of the foreign observers here as arguing that the election itself is a carnival of irrationalism, that Hillary Clinton is a bad candidate, and a dishonest politician, but a more or less safe and orthodox potential president, that Trump is a reckless and unpredictable demagogue, and that his supporters are ill-informed and prejudiced voters who have fallen victim to a dangerous populism. I mean, that's the kind of conventional wisdom in other countries among the intelligentsia. In short, the American electorate is irrational, ill-informed, and populist. The more thoughtful observers concede that the same evils can be seen in Europe, in Brexit, Poland, Hungary, and the rise of populist parties across the continent. Ironically, of course, it's the foreign observers who are inevitably ill-informed. Confident errors are understandable in someone who is far away from the scene and doesn't have the kind of everyday knowledge that would explain why the voters react as they do. For example, the average intelligent European thinks Obamacare was an obvious and necessary social reform, and he can't understand, he doesn't even know, that there's great popular resistance to it now and that practically all its support has fallen away and it is almost certainly will be abandoned. He just doesn't know anything like that, so he is, if the topic comes up, he doesn't understand what's happening. Nor are people abroad concerned with such matters as constitutional process. If they see something like gay marriage going through, they don't ask, or they see Obama ignoring the law on immigration, they don't really follow those arguments. They just assume that they just look at the result. Above all, foreign observers are drawing on a very narrow range of sources for their opinions, and those sources do not include their own experience. Ordinary voters root their views in that experience above all, but among other things. The weakness of Mrs. Clinton's campaign, for instance, is that she has closed her ears to the experience of many voters, especially white former Democrats, on a range of issues, notably Black Lives Matter, anti-cop, and anti-white violence. And she has done that in the interest of a simple message that will arouse her base among minorities by making the maximalist electoral demands on their behalf. Donald Trump himself, in my view, did not set out with a preconceived plan of appealing to the issues in which he has successfully exploited. I think he bumped into those issues more or less by accident and discovered in the process of talking about them that voters were very worried about them because of their experience. He found himself gaining support as a result. Eventually, he adopted a range of issues that previously had been neglected by both parties and found himself winning the primaries and becoming the candidate. I mentioned these two, that the one candidate was going one way and one another, but in fact, no candidate can close his ears to voters on everything, as writers and intellectuals can. Both Clinton and Trump now make protectionist noises. We all know much more about Fishtown and the plight of the white working class than we did 2 years ago. Within different constraints, therefore, Clinton and Trump listen to the voters. But of course, the constraints mean that they listen to different voters in the main. So it's the voters, therefore, who are to blame. Are they irrational, racist, and populist? David Blankenhorn, the president of the Institute of American Values, didn't know anyone who favored Trump. So he decided to go out and meet Trump voters. He spent 2 weeks driving around America's southeast. My home, incidentally, as Larry mentioned, I live in northern Alabama. And he spoke to anyone who would speak to him. The result, an article that extensively quotes ordinary Americans talking about Trump and Clinton, are to be found in the current issue of The American Interest. And I think they are well worth reading and pondering. Among other things, he found that Trump voters, far from being irrational, were realistic, occasionally even cynical, about Trump himself. Those who supported him most strongly did so because they liked the fact that he was not bound by political correctness in speaking about immigration and other issues. He spoke about them as he saw them. Paradoxically, some of the same people disliked his insults to others, his use occasionally of profane language, his inability to control his own mouth, as one man said. They thought these faults were rude and needless and damaging. but they liked what one might call his political profanities all the same. Many of them were skeptical that Trump would do what he promised or succeed even if he tried. But they thought that he was much more likely than any other candidate to try and to succeed. On the whole, they had a low opinion of all politicians and little deep hope of electing a good government. It was merely that Trump offered something better than the establishment politicians. As one supporter said, "What's the worst thing that can happen? He doesn't do what he says he's going to do. Well, I've seen that for the last 30 years. In fact, that's not the worst thing that can happen, alas, but it's still an eloquent comment on the last 30 years. Were their comments racist? I didn't think so. You can read Black and Horn's article and judge for yourself. One had mild criticism of Black Americans working in the health field, but he was a dying man and very likely tetchier than usual. Another was critical of Muslim immigration and its effects. But in the main, the distinctions they made between Americans were rooted in politics and social position far more than race. They are fearful, the people he spoke to. They are fearful about the future, and they have an acute sense of loss. They feel that the America they have known and loved is being taken away and replaced by something worse. They might not use the term, but they are losing Tocquevillian America with its habits of trust and social cooperation. The trust and cooperation which, as even social scientists admit, are damaged and undermined by diversity. Most of them, incidentally, were not badly off. They weren't on drugs or alcoholics, and they weren't unemployed. They were not members of an underclass, left behind by history and economic progress, which is how a lot of the editorial comment often makes them sound, but they were ordinary working or retired Americans who live at one level or another of the great American middle class. If they are dispossessed of anything, they are culturally dispossessed. Are they then populists, attracted by populism? Well, not if the usual meaning of the word populism, that there is a deep vein of wisdom in the common people, has any force. Almost all of them were coolly realistic about their assessments of people, including themselves, including Trump, and including their hopes for the future. What they asserted, and what many people mistake for populism, was that there is a deep vein of arrogance and stupidity in the elites. Trump's people do not glorify themselves, but they are contemptuous of the elites who have governed America for the past few decades. They especially distrusted Hillary Clinton. Blankenhorn could not find a single person who liked or trusted her. At the same time, they didn't see her as anyone very different from those governing them now. She was simply the most representative example of the kind of elitist, progressive politician they have come to dislike and fear. Now, obviously, he's in a part of the world, the Southeast, which is less likely to be pro-Clinton than any other. He'd get different results at Harvard. But nonetheless, these are significant results. So the Trump voters and the U.S. electorate more broadly are neither irrational nor racist nor populist. But they are overwhelmingly hostile to the kind of interventionist, controlling, liberal, progressive, internationalist government that, in their view, has governed them badly for a long time and refused to listen to their complaints. And they are similarly hostile to the national and international elites whom they see as its enablers, enforcers, and supporters. They see, in short, the divide in U.S. politics as one between, well, it has several descriptions, globalists versus nationalists, elites versus voters, democracy versus oligarchy. They see their own elites joined to elites internationally, the whole Leviathan metastasizing at home and abroad. And when foreign observers get over their fun at mocking American elections, they too recognize exactly the same divide in their own politics, thanks in Brexit, in Central Europe's resistance to Brussels, in the growing popular opposition in Germany to the acceptance of millions of Middle East migrants, and in the anxieties everywhere about massive social change organized by governments and global bodies that don't bother to consult their citizens and voters about any of it. This divide is increasingly recognized by political writers as Trump and Brexit-like events have brought it to their attention. It has elicited from conservative writers, in particular, a series of sometimes surprised, sometimes profound, usually shrewd, and in principle almost revolutionary reflections on the nature of this divide and its consequences across the board. These writers include, and this is just a short list, Angelo Codevilla in The American Spectator, the Polish statesman philosopher Richard Legutko in his book The Demon in Democracy, just published here, Walter Russell Mead on the American Interest blog, Todd Huitzinga in his new book The New Totalitarians, Israeli editor Yoram Hazoni in Mosaic, my National Review colleagues Ramesh Ponroo and Yuval Levin, who just point out in a recent article the constitutional threat that Hillary Clinton poses, John Fonte of the Hudson Institute in his critiques of global governance, and that fellow with the Roman name in the Clermont Review, Cato, Seneca, I hope not Petronius, because I was reserving Petronius for my internet rendezvous with destiny. Now, doubtless I have missed other important analyses in my Australian exile, though someone else who has contributed mightily to the critique of legal transnationalism is Professor James Allen of Queensland University. To my mind, however, Yoram Hazoni has given us the most comprehensive account of the clash between these two visions of national and global order, and I will now quote a passage from it. Quote, "What we are seeing is the beginning of a struggle over the character of the international political order itself. For 350 years, Western peoples have lived in a world in which national independence and self-determination were seen as foundational principles. Indeed, these things were held to be among the most precious human concessions and the basis of all our freedoms. Since World War II, however, these intuitions have been gradually attenuated and finally even discredited, especially among academics and intellectuals, media opinion makers, and business and political elites. Today, many in the West have come to regard an intense personal loyalty to the national state and its right to chart an independent course as something not only unnecessary, but as morally suspect. They no longer see national loyalties and traditions as necessarily providing a sound basis for determining the laws we live by, for regulating the economy, or making decisions about defense and security, for establishing public norms concerning religion or education, and for deciding who gets to live in what part of the world." Tonight is not the occasion for a full taxonomy of the many different ways in which this clash plays out across the range of economic, political, foreign, and constitutional policies. For that, read the writers I mentioned. But one aspect deserves, in my view, to be singled out, that of democracy, which flourishes only in the nation state and which cannot really survive in post-national organizations, which invariably have to confess eventually to a democratic deficit. And even when they acknowledge that deficit, somehow it never gets filled in. It was borne in on me during the Brexit campaign that the Leave campaign wanted above all to recover and safeguard Britain's status as a self-governing democracy, while the Remain campaign wanted to avoid discussion of that point altogether. This has continued in the post-Brexit aftermath, in which recidivist Remainers have sought to blame Brexit on popular ignorance, populism, racism, and anything but what the Leavers said plainly and repeatedly was their main aim and motivation. A sad and odd example. One American expert, former American ambassador to Germany, John Kornblum, an able man, illustrates the point. Writing in the same issue of The American Interest of Blankenhorn, he says, I quote, "Look at the key calculation that affected the Brexit vote. It was about how much dole. The European Union provides the depressed Rust Belt parts of Scotland, Wales and England as against what Britain pays into the common pot. The whole idea that the future of the United Kingdom should be decided on the basis of such objective economic weakness and calculative pandering beggars belief. Well, unquote, what truly beggars belief is that anyone could believe such nonsense. The economic arguments in the Brexit campaign of that character almost all came from the Remain camp. They invariably predicted disaster. But they were rejected by the voters. Indeed, they were rejected by the very voters who would have been most hit if the predictions had proved accurate. It was the Rust Belt areas of economic oppression in Britain that voted most heavily, by between 60 and 70%, for Leave. Maybe they simply disbelieved the predictions, and if so, they've been proved right so far. But the evidence is stronger that they were voting to recover and safeguard their political rights. How do we explain the inability of a distinguished and intelligent observer to see what is in front of his nose? One reason, I think, is that globalists tend to judge the value of and by the way, globalists include an enormous number of people in all of the establishment institutions in all of these countries. But one reason I think he made the mistake he did was that globalists judge the value of political decision less by its results than by its provenance. If it's taken by a global body, it is assumed to represent virtue and efficiency. If it's taken by a national government, it is thought to represent selfishness and anarchy. Globalism gets the benefit of every doubt because it allegedly represents the future. Now, one shouldn't be dogmatic. Decisions made by national governments are obviously sometimes wrong. Smoot-Hawley is a case in point. And my own view is that simple protectionism is usually counterproductive. But few national decisions have had such calamitous consequences as the respectively collectivist EU decision to launch and sustain the euro. It persists today because it's not subject to the democratic verdict of any particular European nation. It is upheld by a post-national euro establishment which is really accountable to no one in particular. And in a world of post-democratic globalism, most major decisions would be taken in that way. Who will decide such questions in the US? Washington or some globalist coalition? That is the underlying issue in this election. Mrs. Clinton is plainly a determined globalist, as President Obama has been. Donald Trump is plainly an opponent of that structure. So that being said, it seems to me that says 90% of what you need to know about the coming election. Now, it's certainly a historical inconvenience, and maybe more than that, that the nature of this decision has been obscured by the question of Mr. Trump's personal fitness for the presidency. Let me say that insofar as most people here, I think, probably are not too troubled by that. But even those who are ought to be, at least as troubled and probably more troubled by Mrs. Clinton's personal fitness for the presidency. Let me say that if you were looking for someone who is able to take over, run things quickly and effectively, and make long-sighted decisions, you couldn't do much worse than Stalin. There's no doubt that he was, he knew how to run a government. What he did with that power and knowledge was, of course, something very dangerous. Now, Hazony, in his essay, points out, no matter what happens in November, the political fault line, I quote, the political fault line that has been uncovered at the heart of Western politics is not going away, unquote. The politics of democratic nations are rearranging themselves around this fault line. New candidates for office, maybe more appealing than Trump, maybe less, will take up one or another version of the same cause with consequences we can't now predict. If conservatives, I think it is obvious what follows from this in terms of voting, but if conservatives need further advice on what to do. They can find it, and I never expected to hear myself saying this, in an article in the American Political Science Review. The article dates from 1956. It was written by the late Sam Huntington, and its title is Conservatism as an Ideology. Conservative Huntington said, by the way, I don't suppose a lot of you know this, but I didn't, but Samuel Huntington was the descendant of the same Samuel Huntington who was the president of the pre-United States independent American Republic. He was something he was very proud of, and I think probably influenced his politics in a good direction. But conservatism, Huntington held, was that system of ideas employed to defend established institutions when they come under fundamental attack. When the foundations of society are threatened, the conservative ideology reminds men of the necessity of some institutions and the desirability of existing ones. And when something like the French Revolution comes along, Huntington writes, men are driven to conservatism by the shock of events, by the horrible feeling that a society or an institution which they have approved of or taken for granted may suddenly cease to exist. Well, I don't think anything is going to suddenly cease to exist, but I do think many things are subject to a terrifying slow erosion. What is happening today? What is happening today that most resembles the challenge of something like the French Revolution? Now, any answer must be to some degree speculative. But my own is that the next great challenge can be seen in the gradual undermining of democracy and the shift of power and decision-making from institutions that are accountable to the voters and those that are either accountable to no one but themselves or that inhabit a constitutional limbo where they cannot easily be held to account. We see the harbingers of this challenge across the First World in three developments: the shift of power from legislatures to bureaucratic agencies and the courts brought about by overgovernment, the shift of power from nation states to supranational bodies, and the development of anti-democratic ideas that, lagging behind events, serve to justify these relatively new political practices and to defend the new loci of undemocratic power. Mr. Chairman, I wrote those last three or four lines in 1998 for the Sir Keith Joseph Memorial Lecture. But this is the first time since then that we have been given a clear chance to vote against this threat to our institutions of way of life. Whatever our doubts, however reasonable our doubts, we should not pass this chance up. It may never come again. Thank you. Yeah.